Hello, my name is Sean Macheza, and you're listening to History in Action, 50 Years of Activism and Ideas, a Counter-History by the Transnational Institute. Over the course of 5 episodes, we'll cover some of the major moments that have shaped the international left over the last 50 years. It's a story of ideas, movements, and personalities that have shaped the world today. It's a story of the rise of new forms of capitalism and authoritarianism. It's also the story of a global progressive think tank, the Transnational Institute, or TNI. And above all, it's a story of resistance and hope. In this second episode, we'll meet with some of the people who were active in social movements and radical scholarship in the 1990s. We'll learn about the end of the Cold War, the entrenchment of neoliberalism, and the rise of the ideas and movements that shaped what would come to be known as the alter-globalization movement. Hilary Wainwright is a long-standing fellow of the Transnational Institute, a writer and founder and co-editor of the Red Pepper magazine.
And then came the fall of the wall. And through Mary, I was in touch with dissidents and movements for democracy in Czechoslovakia, Hungary, East Germany. And I was rather naively, with a political romance, sort of taken with the idea that the social movements in the West fighting capitalism could make alliances and have a real dialogue with social movements, dissident movements in the East, fighting for democracy. I thought that would produce a perfect synthesis of democratic socialism. So I suggested this to the TNI that we organise a dialogue. And so we did. And we brought together from the West, from Holland, from Italy, from the UK, and from West Germany. And then we organized, we brought in people from Hungary, from East Germany, from Czechoslovakia, from Slovenia. And we organized this sort of round table, the amazing oval table that there was in Paulus Potestrat. And so we produced this book called After the Wall, Democracy and Movement Politics in the New Europe.
I think there were probably differences within TNI as to how to react towards the kind of developments, what actually seemed to be happening. And this set the tone for the coming period was, in fact, it seemed that now the dominance of the United States, Western imperialism, is now so significant. And this was something that, of course, at least had a largely united response from those of us in TNI. You couldn't look to the Soviet Union for some kind of at least contradictory foreign policy in which they would be supporting certain progressive struggles elsewhere. In fact, in the early period after that, especially with Yeltsin coming in, there was a closer collaboration between the Yeltsin government and the West has emerged triumphant. The ideology was, of course, socialism was a waste of time. This is the only thing that you can do. And many of us, of course, were very much perturbed by this consolidation of the U.S. empire. You had the invasion of Iraq in 1991, the first invasion of Iraq, when Iraq went into Kuwait under Saddam Hussein. And that, of course, created tensions and even certain distances on the left. I don't think it was really there so much in NTIA, but Fred Halliday, for example, supported the invasion. And you had people who were saying on the left, like you have a similar sort of differences on the Ukraine issue. You had on the left there, you had people saying Saddam Hussein is a fascist. And yes, the US is an imperialist, but I'm going to support imperialism against fascism. So it was a tricky period there. But the direction in which Eastern Europe moved was not the desired direction that they were going to move towards a kind of consolidation of a new kind of way towards socialism or towards anti-capitalism?
Yes, I think it varied a bit according to whether one's formation, political formation on the left was to do with a belief in the Soviet Union or a kind of sense that the Soviet Union represented some kind of alternative, or whether me, I suppose, the Berlin Wall didn't fall on me, as it were, it didn't fall on my politics, because in 68, through the combination of the movements against American imperialism on the one hand, but on the other hand, simultaneously, the movements against Soviet control. So the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia took place in 68. And so in a way, one was from the beginning shaped by the idea of a different kind of socialism that wasn't going to follow the path of the Soviet Union, but was going to be about democracy from below. I suppose for anybody who believed in a notion of a command economy and that socialism was about state planning and state intervention and emancipation was going to come through the state, I think the fall of the wall would have been completely shattering, and the fall of the Soviet Union would have shattered their vision of an alternative, and did indeed lead quite a lot of people who came from that Communist Party tradition to be so disillusioned that they accepted not just the idea of the market. Obviously, there needs to be some kind of market mechanism, but the rule of the market, the idea of the market dominating economics as distinct from being a part of an economy dominated by democratic decision making. And so I think it affected the sort of communist organized part of the left, and to some degree the Trotskyist part, that those that tended to believe that socialism could come by democratizing the Soviet state, which, I mean, I'd hoped, but I suppose very quickly the Gorbachev mixture of Gorbachev's weaknesses, the power of the apparatus, the bureaucratic oligarchs in the Soviet Union, and then the aggression of the market in basically moving in to take over and entirely marketize the Soviet economy and its allies in Hungary, or not allies, but its satellites, if you like, the countries it controlled, were so rapidly marketized. And the free market ruled. And that became quite influential on parts of the left. But I think, if you like, the social movement left that believed in kind of democratized state and a socialized market could hold its head up, if not high, at least didn't have its confidence shattered.
Walden Bellow is a TNI fellow. He's been involved with TNI since the early 1990s. He's co-founder and co-chair of the board of Focus on the Global South. He's the author and co-author of more than 25 books. Naomi Klein described him as the world's leading no-nonsense revolutionary.
I would say that most of us in TNI saw the Soviet Union as an important actor in global politics, but that it had its own problems, that basically it was not so much socialism, but a bureaucratic socialism, and that it was undergoing an internal economic crisis, and that Gorbachev was one of the responses to that crisis. But I don't think people in TNI really were that committed to the Soviet model. And as it was collapsing and as China was becoming capitalist, I think that what people became really committed to was economic democracy, that in a political system that would be more participatory. We did not give up on our commitments to a more just, a more democratic world. We did not identify socialism with just either the Soviet model or the Chinese model. And we had our criticisms of both. Yes, it created the space for neoliberalism. And yes, quite a number of groups and forces on the left sort of essentially thought that the time for progressive change that was non-capitalist or anti-capitalist in direction, like the third way people, Clinton and Blair. So there were those that basically gave in to neoliberalism and saw their task as really making the neoliberal process much less, what they called it, to humanize it, which was a contradiction in terms. I would say that the people gathered in TNI did not lose their bearings.
And they did not lose their bearings. In fact, much of the work that happened at TNI and in the broader international left would lay the groundwork for the decades that have followed. Fiona Dove is TNI's longest-serving director. She began working at TNI in 1995 after 15 years as a feminist, socialist, anti-apartheid activist and trade union organizer in South Africa. Here, Fiona tells us about what was going on at TNI in the 1990s.
I think a lot of the work that TNI came to do, the basis for that was laid during this period. Yeah, there was a major focus on militarism. So the question was, okay, the US military, because it was mainly the US at the time, it wasn't going to shut shop. So there was a sense that the US would be trying to construct new enemies as a way to continue to dominate the world. One was focused on the role of UN peacekeepers, the Blue Helmets, as they were called then, who were being heavily criticized for the role that they were playing in the civil wars, that a lot of civil wars emerged. So the UN peacekeepers were playing quite a significant role and were heavily criticized for basically serving as instruments of the dominant geopolitical powers. So there was also a look at how Islam, so this project actually began, I think, around 1992, and the book only came out, I think, around 94, 5, but was looking at how Islam was being constructed as the next threat, as the next cover for US intervention, particularly in the Middle East, Central Asia, and so forth. I think that was very prescient, and I think shaped a whole generation's sense of what was coming. It took 10 years before 9/11 happened, so this was nearly 10 years before that, already thinking like that. It's also interesting that TNI then was looking at the end of nuclear weapons. So there was a sense that, okay, if it's the end of the Cold War, then it should also be the end of nuclear weapons, because nuclear weapons in so many ways defined the threat of the Cold War. And at that time, there were negotiations underway for the extension of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So a lot of work was being done, also critically, because the NPT extension suggested that those who had nuclear weapons got to keep them. It's just no one else could get them. That was basically what those negotiations were about. Yeah, so I think, and we also had books underway at that time that were published the following year, focused on Russia, with a particular look at Chechnya. So I think that was also very forward-looking, considering the politics of today and the last decade and a half.
But of course, with the Soviet Union fading into history, U.S. hegemonic power was now without a rival. And so the U.S. and U.K. free market fundamentalism of the 1980s spread unchecked through the international community and its institutions. Here's Achin Fanaik.
There was strong hostility to the neoliberal turn, which of course took place from the 80s. It was resisted both in the United States and in UK. It was resisted, and it is only after the resistance was defeated that it was able to consolidate itself. And what you found is that in France, Mitterrand came, to power, and he tried to do some progressive reforms and was constrained from doing so. And there was a turn towards accepting the more neoliberal direction. There are always variations because neoliberalism is a kind of direction, not a state of affairs. And therefore, different countries are at different starting points and they move at different pace there. But look at the United States. When the neoliberal turn took place, you had the defeat of PATCO and the workers' struggle there. You have a resistance within the other party, which is the Democratic Party. That organizational resistance within was the Jesse Jackson Rainbow Coalition. That is defeated. And after that is defeated, you have the Clinton New Democrats. What did you have in the UK? You have Benism fighting against the neoliberal turn. You're having an organizational resistance within the main opposition party, the Labour Party. That is defeated, and you have the emergence of Blairism and Blairite New Labour. What this meant was that the two main parties in both these countries were now into neoliberalism, either compensatory or disciplinary or compensatory, but neoliberalism. And neoliberalism was a turn which was taking place internationally. It was connected globally through the constitutionalization of a kind of neoliberal capitalist globalization by the Bretton Woods institutions that got consolidated. And my own understanding of that is that in India, you had the turn towards neoliberalism in the late 80s, 1990s, but there was, unlike in UK and USA, you did not have any internal organizational struggle to oppose it. It was brought in by the Congress Party from the top. And that's because the Congress Party by that time only had a kind of paternalistic relationship. It didn't even have the kind of organizational structure that Labour had or the Democrats had here. And then you began to have this neoliberalism going in very different directions with some exceptions. And along with it, you had what I would call the rise of the politics of cultural exclusivism. Neoliberal turn was the most strongest right-wing version of capitalist globalization, of capitalist development, a strongly shift to the right, away from earlier Keynesianism and the welfare state, and away from developmentalist efforts in the third world countries, state-led developmentalism. It was a right-wing shift. Now, this right-wing shift is taking place globally, but the world is divided into multiple nation states. And if this neoliberalism is going to be stabilized, there has to be a corresponding right-wing shift in politics and ideology. And this will take nationally specific forms because we're divided, because the state plays the crucial role in stabilizing it and helping to also coordinate. And even, of course, in policing the losers, being much more. So what you begin to have as a result of neoliberal globalization was on increasing inequalities of income and wealth, continuation of mass poverty, the erosion of democracy in the existing democratic states, partly countered by the fact that now, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, you also began to have the expansion in a procedural sense of democracies in Europe to a limited extent. So you have more elections and all that, still very weak. But in the strong liberal democratic countries, of course, it's being eroded and you're having much more acts here.
Clearly, in the 1990s, already opposing neoliberalism was a major theme. And this was also the time that the Soviet Union had collapsed. And this was unipolar America. And how do we deal with this now very power because it no longer has a rival? So that was a major issue. And of course, this was the time that the IMF and the World Bank were celebrating their 50th anniversary. And it was, the sense was that 50 years was enough. And these were the major themes that worried us, that we dealt with. And this was also a time when we were trying to figure out how, basically, after the period of colonization had passed, and there had been hopes that developing countries, third world countries, would have more development space, but that had not occurred. And there was just this sense that globalization was on the rise. And just dealing with the triumphalism of globalization. And a lot of our efforts then were geared towards not only dealing with the World Bank and the IMF and working with others in civil society that were engaged in trying to curb their power, but also the new organization, the World Trade Organization, had come into being. So quite a lot of us were involved with trying to figure out how to organize against the World Trade Organization. And many of us were, in fact, participants in the global campaigns against the World Trade Organization, against the World Bank and the IMF, against the G7. And so TNI was a very important place for the exchange, not only of ideas, but tactics, because what you had was the coming together of committed intellectuals and activists and activist intellectuals. So it was like, really, these were people who were not detached from the struggle. Quite a number of groups and forces on the left sort of essentially thought that the time for progressive change that was non-capitalist or anti-capitalist in direction, like the third way people, Clinton and Blair. And so it was not clear what exactly the new system was, but people did not sit around thinking about it. They organized, they mobilized, they went to Seattle, they went to Genoa, they brought down the WTO in Seattle and in Cancun. So the response of people on the global left, a significant section of us, was not demoralization, but to continue to fight according to the values that we felt was very important to uphold: democratic values, participatory values. So as you can see, both with respect to globalization, the resistance of the progressive movement was very important in basically stopping globalization, in discrediting it.
We were exploring alternative visions of development then, and that was mainly work we were doing with respect to Asia. It was the kind of beginnings of what today is the Asia-Europe People's Forum, and then it hadn't quite taken that form, but it was work being done between social movements and NGOs in Southeast Asia mainly, and counterparts in Europe. But it was exploring what would an alternative development look like and what would an alternative globalization look like. So those were the roots of kind of what came to be called the global justice movement, or the, how would we put it? Yeah, fair globalization or a just globalization.
U.S. foreign policy, now unrivaled, began to coalesce around a new enemy and a new war. A war with no victories, but with casualties on every continent. The so-called war on drugs. Martin Jelsma has worked on TNI's Drugs and Democracy program for 3 decades. When he received the Alfred R. Lindesmith Award for achievements in the field of scholarship, it was noted that Martin is increasingly recognized as one of, if not the, outstanding strategists in terms of how international institutions deal with drugs and drug policy.
I was already involved in solidarity work with Central America. I had been also living for a year in Nicaragua, in part to finish my studies, but also to as an internacionalista, supporting the Sandinista project. And that was also how I got drawn first in contact with TNI, but also how I got drawn into the work, because TNI had a Central America project at the time. If you think back to the late 80s, early 90s, Central America was still a hotspot of Cold War conflict. There were, Guatemala, had decades of civil war. After the Sandinista revolution in 79, things started to heaten up because there was fear from the US side that communist revolutions might expand from Nicaragua into the rest of the region. It also sparked more activity in El Salvador with the FMLN, who became much stronger and more active, also by then had support from Nicaragua. The Central America project that I initially helped to, I didn't initiate it, it was Kees Bikart was the one who drew me into TNI. So it was a project that focused on Central America peasant movements. And it was in the context of the democratic transition that was starting to happen at the time. Now, the military dictatorships had ended. There were transitions to elections were taking place. Peace negotiations were happening. Now, it's led in, I think, 92 to the agreement in El Salvador and 96 in Guatemala. So it was, the aim of the project was to assist the very dispersed movement of peasants in the seven Central American countries who had all come, or many had come from a situation of clandestinity in the war and also of repression. So they started to organize themselves more openly, publicly, and they wanted to have also regional coordination. There was already a collaboration with CRIES, a research institute in Nicaragua. We helped to assemble a group of agrarian experts to work very closely together with these initiating farmers' organizations and work out together an alternative agrarian policy for the whole region. We also helped to give this new ASACODE, the network, a platform in Europe. And it was indeed also the start of the Via Campesina, which at that time we worked with the original founders. That project lasted about 3 years, but what happened, and that is also how the drugs issue came into play and what led to the start of the drugs program. Basically two big elements in it. The one was that, especially in Guatemala, opium poppy cultivation had become a bit a refugee economy. So as part of the war, of course, a lot of the indigenous Mayan communities were brutally repressed. No, this was really a brutal civil war, or not even a civil war. It was almost a genocide. Like 200,000 are estimated to have been killed in those years. Some of those communities, to survive, had taken up opium poppy cultivation for heroin production in Mexico. So it was all destined for the US market, but it was for them a way to survive. Yeah, what happened that even in the midst of this war, the US and the DEA started to spray those opium poppy fields with dramatic consequences. Not only it destroyed, of course, the livelihood that they had been trying to find, but also it led to serious pollution, but also poisoning of population. They used 2,4-D in the spraying, which was one of the ingredients that was also used in Vietnam as a defoliant. Nobody was talking about it. There were dramatic incidents. One village where 22 people died after a spraying operation. Mm-hmm. And the madness of, in the midst of this war, to then add fuel to the fire by just spraying chemicals on people who wanted to survive, was just unbelievable. So just when I was busy with the Central America project at TNI, the other thing that happened was that, of course, the Contra war against Nicaragua was partly funded by illegal cocaine smuggling, the Iran-Contra scandal at the time, Oliver North, etc. So there were military, ex-Guardia, but also military from other countries, including Guatemala, were involved in helping to get this illegal stream up for the Contras as one of the paramilitary forces to push back against this threat of revolution in the region. And what we feared, and I think correctly, was that at the moment that after the peace accords, early 90s, El Salvador, Guatemala, there was, of course, a process of dismantling the most repressive parts of the military apparatus, so military intelligence, the death squad type organizations, and there were a lot of weapons there, mm-hmm. and they were already involved in drug trafficking because to fund the control. So what we feared was that part of the dismantling of that repressive apparatus would lead to the establishment of criminal organizations that would just continue to be a threat to the democratization process and the demilitarization process by self-funding, by continuing to be involved in the drug trade. And of course, a lot of the demobilized military got involved in gangs, but also there were some really powerful military people who were thrown out that did link up with like Mexican cartels and became powerful and of course destabilizing force at the moment when the situation was still very fragile. The democratization process was still in peril and could easily be derailed by irregular groups like organized crime. And indeed, you could see in Guatemala that even after the formal transition to democracy and the start of the dismantling of the military apparatus, death squads continued to operate. And indeed, they were starting to self-fund, and this very toxic mix of former military intelligence with organized crime groups and with death squad activities became a very serious thing. So on those two issues, so both the farmer side and this risk of this explosive mix of military and organized crime groups, those were the two initial focus points of the reason why we started to think about a special project on drugs policy. On the farmer side, what became also clear was that even the formal farmers' organizations that were starting to build up, including Via Campesina, that they were not willing to take up these cases of members who were involved in illegal cultivation. Because they felt it was already precarious, difficult to start and to then also become seen as defending farmers involved in illegal drug production. They thought it was too risky to even talk about. That was an issue in Guatemala with the opium poppy, but also like in Costa Rica with cannabis farmers who were thrown in jail for just having part of their land with cannabis cultivation. It was clear that the official farmers' organizations were not really willing to take up this issue. We thought there has to be another way to start working with specifically those farmers' groups and communities that are involved for survival in illicit cultivation of whatever drug-linked crops. And then the other part. No, one of the first publications was called Crime in Uniform. Mm-hmm. So that was focused on the other side, the military involvement in the drug trade and the risk to democratization, demilitarization, peace building of this mix of those people from the repressive apparatus with organized crime groups. So when we started then the drugs program, it was 94, 95, what had happened was that by then the spraying campaign in Guatemala was basically finished, but the US brought the spraying planes from Guatemala to Colombia. And yes, from 92 basically on, spraying started to happen aggressively, even at a much higher scale than it ever happened in Guatemala, against both cannabis, opium poppy, and coca cultivation, because all three plants are grown in Colombia. It's more or less the only country where all three plants are grown. And of course, we knew the consequences of those kinds of operations. We knew nobody else was going to defend the farmers that were the victim of these spraying campaigns. So that was one of the first focus of the drugs program. Of course, it was very connected to the internal conflict, because there was no peace agreement in Colombia yet. Still, the war there still went on for much longer. And many of the people involved in illicit cultivation there were internal displaced people who had fled from paramilitary violence, moved towards the south, more towards the Amazon areas, and started to find their way to survive, including by growing these crops. Again, the aggressive war on drugs that unfolded in Colombia became a fuel on the fire of the conflict in various ways, because it also funded in part the armed groups that were fighting against the government, because the displaced people mainly moved to their areas. Mm-hmm. So they were taxed. So also the armed groups became, in that sense, involved in taxing the illegal economy. No, not so much in producing the cocaine or the heroin. That was still more the organized criminal groups, and the cartels in Colombia. But the primary material, the cultivation and the first the coca pastes, was taxed and became a very important source of income for especially the FARC, the biggest armed group at that time. So that played a role, and of course that was an additional reason to spray even more aggressively, because the objective was also to take away this relatively new income stream for the guerrilla. And at the same time, the war on drugs also undermined any attempt to have peace negotiations, and it of course made many people even more angry with the government, because they were refugees, and then the only contact with the government was that they came to spray poison on their fields. So many also then joined the guerrilla. So it had all kinds of fueling effects on the conflict. One of the first bigger projects was in collaboration, of course, with local partners to travel through the areas of the sprayed, especially coca fields, but also opium poppy, and to document what was going on, and also to start to become involved in conversations about the terms of a peace agreement. There were initial talks going on around that time already, and we were drawn into that also to draw on lessons from from Central America, where the drugs issue or the war on drugs was no factor at all in the peace negotiations. And now in Colombia, where that was even a much bigger factor, yeah, it felt that it was crucial to take this element, this fueling element, into account in the peace negotiations. That's the context. So Colombia became an important focus of the program, but then also through the context with especially the coca farmers in Colombia, we started working with coca farmers in Bolivia, in Peru. They were trying to also set up a coordination platform specifically for coca farmers. I think from there, the drugs and conflict relationship, which has always been one of the elements of the program, then also moved on to Burma, to Myanmar, because there were similar dynamics at play over there. And there were more parallels to the lasting conflict in both these countries that we also felt were relevant to at least exchange lessons about. There was already a collaboration with the Burma Center and with the Asia Project in TNI. So from there, Burma became the other focus of attention also on the drugs program side. The work with the farmers, which was the start of it and is still today one of the important parts of the drugs program, we also quite quickly realized that a lot of this pressure to spray, but also the whole war on drugs concept and the repression, was very connected to the international drug treaties, to the international drug control system. And there was, at that time, there were preparations for a special session of the General Assembly in New York in 1998 about the drugs issue. And it was triggered mainly by Colombia, by the Colombian government at that time, who also thought that the way it was going now and the pressure this war on drugs put on the internal conflict was not going anywhere. And they proposed to have a reflection at the international level about possible other scenarios, other policies, changes. That was the moment that we also, with the program, hooked up, became involved in the UN level drug policy meetings, including these preparations for the special session. We helped to organize the sending some coca farmers to New York, including at the time also Eva Morales, who was then still the head of the Coca Farmers Union, but of course later became president. And I think he, at that first attempt, he wasn't even allowed to get into the US or the UN building. Yeah, so it was tense, but it became another important focus of the drugs program to find a way to influence these policy processes at the UN level. But also to help to give especially those groups of farmers a voice in the international arena, so that they could themselves tell what was happening to them and also be part of a discussion to reform policies at that international level. Mm-hmm. And because we were, as TNI, we were one of the very first sort of civil society groups that entered these spaces on about drug policy at the UN level. There wasn't much civil society activity around these meetings, and most of them were working with drug users or more on the consumption side, and many of them did not question at all the fundamental prohibitionist principles, and nobody was looking at the effects that it had on countries like Colombia or Burma. We became a very critical voice within that international space, and also helped to grow that space and conquer more access for also critical civil society and for farmers to have their voice heard in some way in these on the research side, the drugs program, because it's by now like 30 years that we've been dealing with also the UN level drug policy. We became very specialized in how this all worked with the Commission on Narcotic Drugs and the International Narcotics Control Board and the scheduling system and the treaties and what that UN system of the treaties and implementing UN agencies, how that related to this war on drugs that we were helping to fight against on the ground with farmers in Southeast Asia and Latin America.
As neoliberal globalization advanced, so too did its discontents. Food, trade, militarism, land, democracy itself were to play for, and activists around the world were stepping up. Here's June Borras.
A key moment was November 1996 at the World Food Summit in Rome, where hundreds of movements converged in Rome around agrarian and food issues. Food sovereignty was basically inaugurated at a global stage. That was a pivotal moment when food sovereignty became a rallying campaign to which many justice movements were able to relate to. And then quickly it plugged into the raging World Trade Organization campaign and the unfolding of negotiation around the World Trade Organizations, around which agrarian agricultural trade issues were central. And then you have 1999, the Battle of Seattle, in which suddenly the leading force became very quickly and very clearly La Via Campesina and other agrarian and food movements, and then followed quickly by a negotiation around WTO in Cancun in Mexico. So it was around the time when suddenly at the global stage of justice movements, the leading force was agrarian movements, La Via Campesina.
Manuel Perez Roca is an associate fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies and a regular contributor to TNI's trade and investment and corporate power work. The struggles against post-Cold War trade regimes have been a key component of the international left's quest for justice and solidarity over the last three decades.
I think that the battles or the struggles against so-called free trade agreements have always been central to the left agenda. The 1st of January of 1994 is the key date that catalyzed the many struggles to come. It is the date when the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, came into effect, and the same day when the Zapatista National Liberation Army uprised in the highlands of Chiapas. And through the novelty that the internet was then, the Zapatistas inspired local struggles, I would say, in every corner of the world, and social movements like the Via Campesina. But let's recall that before the Zapatista uprising, before 1994, there was in Mexico already a broad opposition to NAFTA. Since the negotiations started, rural organizations, trade unions, environmentalists, women organizations, coalesced, came together to form the Mexican Action Network on Free Trade, the REMALC, a network that worked in many projects. This network was also key in forming the Hemispheric Social Alliance, the HSA, which is a continental network from Canada to Argentina, that learning from the negative experiences of NAFTA in Mexico, moved on to defeat the George Bush project of the Free Trade Area of the Americas, which would be the extension of NAFTA in the rest of the hemisphere. It was defeated in 2005. And this was a key victory for social movements. And TNI and REMALC indeed helped to create another network called Enlazando Alternativas, which means linking alternatives. It was a network of organizations of Latin America and Europe but many of the bonds still persist in much of the work that we are carrying on nowadays on the renewed push from the European Union for free trade agreements in Latin America.
Gonzalo Beron is a member of TNI's corporate power team. He's been active since the year 2000 in international mobilizations against different expressions of the corporate agenda as part of trade union organizations, as well as other civil society networks and campaigns in Latin America.
You must remember that the World Social Forum began there in Brazil. And I always remember Britt Brennan walking around the corridors in Porto Alegre. And then she started to push for a dialogue between Latin America and the Caribbean. And that was when we started to develop in a closer way this common work and common effort, no? And that was when we figured out that there was a need of a dialogue between Europe and America, because the free trade agreements and the trade agreements and investment agreements were not only at the global level and at the Americas level, but also with Europe. That there were some particularities, but that was also important to develop and to develop a dialogue between unions and civil society organizations and so on and so forth from the two regions. And that was the origin of Enlazando Alternativas, that alliance that we created in 2003, if I'm right, or four. We had a first activity in Guadalajara, and that was the launching of this. One of the interesting things of that process is that we organized counter summits to the EU CELAC. That it was not CELAC by that time, but it was EU, Latin America, and the Caribbean summits. One time in Europe and the other in Latin America or the Caribbean. And we developed alternative summits to that. And that was the case in Guadalajara. And it was amazing because first, Guadalajara was a kind of a violent scenario because the pressure was super, super high and hard, I could say. And we suffered a lot, and many people suffer even more because many foreigners were in jail or Mexicans were in jail, not only physical violence, but also another kind of violence that was harassment to women. It was horrible, really. And that was the context where Las Alternativas started to work. And it was also important because we managed to have Evo Morales when he was still a rising leader, not yet the president of Bolivia, but Cocalero leader that was involved also in the anti-globalization movement. It was wonderful to have the guy there. He is always so nice. That was a kind of a colorful moment in the Alternativa process.
And through all this, the movements continued to better define their opponent and to refine their own tactics and strategies.
I went back from Washington to start working in Mexico. So I was perhaps the first person who brought the issue of the MAI, the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, the intention of creating a multilateral agreement on investment at the OECD. And I was the one who brought the issue to Mexico, because Mexico was part of the OECD, was the first developing country that joined the OECD, which is the club of rich countries, of course. And there was a lot of interest also in people of the north in bringing me, for example, once to Paris to a consultation that ended up in a failure for the government. And they were interested in me because of the experience that Mexico had already had with ISDS, in the case of NAFTA, or the case of Metalclad, the Metalclad, the California asbestos company that sued Mexico under NAFTA. So that's how I got involved with groups mainly in the US and in Europe in fighting ISDS. And as also during the time, we were also very concerned about what we call the Singapore issues. It was not only trade and investment, but also government procurement trade facilitation and competition policy. So these issues that weren't exactly about trade, but of expanding the power of corporations over governments, this is what provoked the enormous protests at Seattle and then in Cancun. And these are struggles and battles that civil society organizations really won, not allowing the expansion of the WTO to incorporate all these issues and all these rights for corporations. Then we've had other victories like the FTAA, and then also, yeah, in 2015, the US and the European Union tried to achieve a transatlantic trade and investment partnership with ISDS and all, and we defeated it again.
Many of the world's social movements, their processes and dynamics, and their striving for an alternative to neoliberal globalization would come together in the World Social Forum.
The World Social Forum came very much out of the campaigning and alternatives built up around Davos and the World Economic Forum. There'd been a whole kind of history of social movements challenging and protesting. There was the most significant in my memory was the great movement against the World Trade Organization and the closing down of its meeting in Seattle and the kind of coming together of new movements, green movements, feminist movements. That was the impetus behind the World Social Forum, the idea that another world is possible. And in a way, because it happened in Brazil and Porto Alegre, it was also saying, look, another world is emerging. So in a way, Porto Alegre was an example of a very new kind of vision of politics being left, socialist politics being about not just taking state power, this was local state power, but also democratizing it through the taking finance, normally the center of power, and opening it up to the people in a very democratic kind of way. And so the World Social Forum both highlighted what was emerging, and then it brought together movements, including many movements that were themselves engaged in alternatives, whether it was the Via Campesina that in many countries is developing alternative agriculture, or the movement for workers' control in Argentina. So it was a very inspiring experience where the panels were not just critique, but were trying to generalize from and learn from emerging alternatives. The World Social Forum probably was the sort of global event that in turn shifted TNI, because in a way, the World Social Forum provided TNI with a kind of a partner.
Leader Fernanda Forero is a TNI associate who was a part of the TNI team for almost 10 years and considers TNI her political home. She's originally from Colombia and has been involved with Colombian and Latin American movements for almost 20 years. She describes her time with TNI as a window to global movements and regional movements in other places like Europe, Asia, and Africa.
We need to go back in history to the global resistance, to the free trade agreements and the globalization, the anti-globalization movement, if we can say that. In the Americas, the campaign against the free trade area of the Americas, which was between the US and Canada, US and Latin America, that campaign brought a lot of movements together, helped to develop an understanding, resistance, and alternatives against that globalization and free trade model. And at the time, the European Union was seen as this democratic region, let's say. So it was the opposite to the US. And when the free trade, at the time it was not free trade agreement, it was the partnership agreements, economic partnership agreements, EPA. Similar to the case with the US. First, Latin America and the Caribbean with the European Union, the continent. It was a way to see the reproduction of the model with that region that in the imaginary was democratic. So it was necessary to confront and see how the European Union was also developing neoliberal narratives and policies. The same policies, of course, with differences and nuances, but the neoliberal framework was both in Europe and in Latin America. So understanding that was that brought together the organization from both continents. In the case of Latin America, there was an existing network, which was Hemispheric Social Alliance, and I was working there. And from the side of Europe, there was not an alliance that brought everyone together in the same way. Maybe the S2B network, the Seattle to Brussels network, was something similar to that, but less cohesive than the HSA. But anyway, was the resistance to the neoliberal policies, both within the regions and between the regions, what brought together Enlazando Alternativo, opposition to the free trade agreements, the economic partnership agreements, and the analysis and the resistances against the actions of the European corporations in Latin America. Those were the main pillars of Enlazando Alternativo. Then, of course, you have different topics that come together with the relation in between the regions, like migration, environment. Yeah, I remember migration was one of those key issues. But I will say the two pillars were the resistance to the agreements and the criticism of the human rights violations by European corporations. All of that in the framework of the neoliberal policies and how neoliberal policies were affecting peoples on both regions. So solidarity was understood through that way, through how we all are affected. Of course, it is different. There are in-depth differences, but neoliberal policies were affecting all of us, and therefore we could resist them. And that's how it came together, I think it was 2006, with the first EU Latin America summit, the official one by heads of state. So that was first an initial exchange with the Mexican organizations. And then for the next one, then there was the summit in 2000 in Lima. And that was, in my memory, one of the biggest summits with more than 5,000 people participating. We had Evo Morales at the time, and it was like those massive events that we could bring together. And then from there, we had the global campaign to dismantle corporate power. That was the inception. The People's Tribunal was the inception of the global campaign that is now running very strong.
There was a wave of free trade agreements, and Europe was proposing partnership agreements to the different blocs in Latin America. Then, as our agenda was as HSA, we started to look at these agreements, and we understand that we needed counterparts, let's say, in partners in Europe to follow the negotiations and to oppose to them. And that was how we started this dialogue, this conversation. No, the unions already have a mechanism for that, but the civil society organizations, they don't. We accept that. And we found this space that we created, indeed, in Enlazando Alternativas as that umbrella space for conversations on trade issues, but also on transnational corporations. And that was key for us, and that was key our present, no? Because in the context of this neoliberal globalization in the 90s, many globalization processes and the deregulation and the investment, foreign investment peak, let's say, many European companies came to Latin America. They came to Latin America and they made disasters, of course. They went to other regions, but as we were here in Latin America, we understood that was later called neocolonialism, but we didn't use those words by that time. but just an expression of neoliberal corporate agenda and so on and so forth. So I identified that as a problem because there were many European corporations operating here with many cases of violation of human rights. So that was the kind of the second agenda that lately became the most important agenda within Enlazando Alternativa. And that was we understood that we should develop something. And I always remember Britt Brennan proposing the tribunals to organize tribunals on corporations operating in Latin America. And we managed to organize that. It was a spectacular thing because these tribunals that are opinion tribunals, the popular tribunals, really helped in the victims and the grassroots organizations operating at a territory level. And then suddenly we have some 50 cases from all over Latin America explaining or bringing their problems with European corporations. And that was amazing, really. The first one was in Vienna, in one of those summits. And yes, for us, it was an spectacular tool to show how that works. And to show the similarities and what we call the systemic character of that, no? There was a challenge because there were opinion tribunals. The affected communities had problems and expectations and hopes that this may help them to solve their problems. In some cases, you have direct solutions to the problem by visibilizing, no? By making the problems visible, the companies immediately react. After three sessions of those tribunals, we understood that something else should be done, mostly because there was a need to counter more actively the corporate power of the companies, and that must be done at the global level because same companies were operating in other continents, as Africa and Asia, and not only were companies from European origin, but also from America, from the US and Canada, and that we should organize that to answer to these two questions or three questions. And that was how we decided to launch the global campaign to stop, dismantle corporate power and stop impunity out of this very fruitful process of linking alternatives between Latin America and Europe organizations.
In the next episode, we learn about the evolution of the movements against corporate power and neoliberal trade, the rise of powerful alternatives, as well as the grim specter of the war on terror. You've been listening to History in Action, 50 Years of Activism and Ideas, a five-part mini-series by the Transnational Institute on its 50th anniversary. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You can discover more about the Transnational Institute at tni.org. Please consider supporting our vital ongoing work at tni.org/donate. Interviews for this podcast were conducted by Sean Macheza, Daria Gorshenina, and Dennis Burke, with archival interviews by Eric Hymans, Fiona Dove, Geoff Arborn, and Breed Brennan. The series is edited and produced by the Transnational Institute. Thanks to Eden Raskin, Susan Buck-Morse, Anthony Burnett, Fiona Dove, Eric Hymans, and the International Institute for Social History.